little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand. And what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying. Think for yourself, little.
Welcome to a show called Thinking Clearly, a show about critical thinking and related topics. My name is Bob Frelick, along with...
I'm Julia Minton.
And if we coax Julia, I'm sure she can tell you how you can get a hold of us, how you can give us information that you'd like to give us and feedback about this show, and how you can get the archive versions of our podcast previous shows.
Why, yes, Bob. Yes, I can.
And I asked nicely, didn't I?
Well, I do want to say we communicate through many methods, but it is not the time of year for smoke signals. You can email us.
That's right.
We have a Facebook page. Just type in Thinking Clearly in your search bar on Facebook. And, you know, we always have updates and show notes. And when the show is done, it gets uploaded as a podcast, where you can also add that into your podcast app. Just say add feed, search Thinking Clearly, or visit our website, thinkingclearly.libsyn.com.
And you can go back to our over 3 years of shows.
Has it been 3 years?
Yes, it's been over 3 years.
Wow. So, talk about a time warp.
I know. And Julia's right. No smoke signals at this time of the year. Burn permits have been lifted. Well, let's start with a quote from our guest on this episode of Thinking Clearly. It goes like this, quote, "I believe that science is the greatest invention the human mind has ever created for gathering empirical knowledge. As such, it's worth understanding, emulating, and defending," end quote. And our guest, who we'll be meeting very shortly, is a strong supporter of science, but is going to make the case that contrary to popular belief, there really may be no such thing as the scientific method. But there is another, more defensible way of explaining the effectiveness of science. So topics are going to include what tonight, Julia?
Tonight we're going to be talking about the nature of science denial and the strengths of science for describing and understanding the world around us, the scientific attitude versus the scientific method. For those of you, since we're on the radio, I did that with air quotes, the scientific attitude versus the scientific method. And we're going to be exploring these sort of philosophical ideas around science.
Mm-hmm. And our guest on this edition of Thinking Clearly is a philosopher, educator, and author. His name is Lee McIntyre, with a PhD in philosophy. Lee is a research fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University and an instructor in ethics at Harvard Extension School. And he's authored a number of books, including Post-Truth, Respecting Truth, with a subtitle of Willful Ignorance in the Internet Age, Dark Ages, with a subtitle of The Case for a Science of Human Behavior, and his latest book, The Scientific Attitude. And he's also edited several other books and published numerous essays and articles. So, Professor Lee McIntyre, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for joining us. Yeah, well, I guess we should just get right to it, huh?
We may as well.
I wanted to first make sure that you can hear me clearly, and I wanted to apologize because given the time of night here on the East Coast, I've got two very sleepy German shepherds at my feet, so if you hear any gnawing or whining, it's not me.
Okay. Well, if they start gnawing on you, let us know.
Okay.
And thank you so much for joining us past at least my bedtime.
Yeah.
So I've been looking forward to it all day. Thank you.
Well, I'm really excited. For those who know me, I have a background in philosophy. I studied philosophy. So I was really excited when I heard your specialty is the philosophy of science. So I could see how that sort of thinking, those sort of ideas could lead you to your latest book, which is entitled The Scientific Attitude, Defending Science from Denial, Fraud, and Pseudoscience. Could you tell us why the subject matter of this book is important in general, why it might be more important at this time, and what are the dangers of science denialism?
Sure. So as a philosopher of science, I've been studying science really my entire career. Philosophers of science are obsessed with this question of what's distinctive about science and how science can be differentiated from other things that are not scientific, sometimes just because they're not, or sometimes because they're pretending to be and they're not. And the more I thought about this issue just as an academic, the more I became disenchanted with the idea that we really knew what was distinctive about science, because there's something called the problem of demarcation that actually this year in 2019 is 100 years old, and nobody has solved it yet. And what occurred to me is that that's really not just a scandal for philosophers of science, but what it means is that these days when science is under attack from science deniers and others, it means that philosophers are really of no use. Philosophers were not really able to defend science, which most of us want to do. And it's led to a sort of the scandalous reputation that philosophers of science have had over the years, according to scientists anyway. Richard Feynman, the Nobel Prize winning physicist, once said that philosophy of science was as useful to scientists as ornithology was to birds. And that just sort of sums it up. We really weren't helping, and they weren't paying attention to what we were doing. And so a couple of years ago, I started to think about, well, what do I think really is distinctive about science? And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, we have to come up with an account of this. We have to have something that makes sense to the general public, something that is actually true, that is what's distinctive about science, but also works, something that we can use to fight back against the science deniers, because the people who deny climate change or vaccines or evolution are growing, and a growing threat to us, I believe.
It's pretty amazing. If I think back 20 years ago, I never would have thought that on April 22nd, 2017, there would actually have to be a march for science. I mean, that's an amazing thing. It was wonderful to see that support, but it was kind of mind-boggling that we actually needed that, you know, needed to get out there and show our support for science.
Why was it necessary? I mean, 600 cities around the world. I was at the one in Boston, and I have a little bit at the beginning of my book, The Scientific Attitude, where I talk about it. I saw signs that said things like, "It's so severe, the nerds are here," and no science, no Twitter. So, I mean, they were very clever, nice signs, but the one that really captured it for me was the one that said, "I can't believe I had to leave my lab to do this."
Yes, I saw that one.
And that's the point, I think, that scientists are really busy in the lab. So why do they need to be out defending facts, defending reason? And the reason is because it's under attack, just unbelievably. My earlier book, Post-Truth, was about the threat to facts and truth. The threat to science, I think, is part of that.
And I do want to remind listeners that we will open the phone lines around 7:40 or so for your questions for Professor McIntyre or your comments on the topic that we're discussing this evening. In your book, your most recent book, The Scientific Attitude, you make the point that many defenders of science discuss its primary strength as having a definite method. A brief version of that being, well, first we make observations, and from those we develop hypothesis, and from that hypothesis then we make a testable prediction, and then test that prediction with an experiment. We analyze the results of the experiment, which may support the hypothesis or cause us to reject or to revise our hypothesis. And that is kind of a flow scheme in most introductory textbooks on science. And we've all come to sort of rely on that as a core methodology of science. But at the start of chapter one of Scientific Attitude, you say, quote, "If there's one thing that the majority of philosophers of science agree on, It's the idea that there is no such thing as the scientific method. So help us understand how philosophers, including you, have come to that conclusion.
Okay. So I, of course, I was being provocative at the beginning of the chapter to get people to keep reading, but I actually believe this. And I think that, in fact, you might be surprised to know that most philosophers of science believe as well that there's no such thing as scientific method. Now, what I'm intending to say here is not that scientists don't follow any sort of rules or that they don't have any plan when they go out into the world, when they're looking for things, because they do. And all the things that you mentioned about observation and prediction and revising your hypothesis based on the prediction, those are all actually things that scientists do. But the question of whether there's a scientific method has to do with whether or not there's a recipe, whether or not there's this set of lists, this list or set of rules that you can follow that works the same way every time across all sciences. And it just doesn't seem to work that way. It's a caricature. It's the thing that we all read in the first page of our biology or physics textbook in college. They say it's the most assigned page, but the least read by the students, but I read it. And it just, as I said, it's a caricature of science. It's not how science actually works. And all the way back to Karl Popper and Thomas Kuhn and, you know, other great names in the philosophy of science, they don't believe in it. So even somebody as eminent as Karl Popper, who is the one who really started this obsession with the problem of demarcation and wants to solve it, he had an essay called Why There Is No Such Thing as Scientific Method. And this was back in the 1920s.
It sounds basically like you're saying that there is a method out there, which is kind of an idealization, but that on the ground, science doesn't always take those steps in that order. Is that basically what you're saying?
Well, I guess how to put it, it would be like saying that I think it's a skill set more than a method, or really what I argue in the book is it's an attitude, it's an orientation that we have toward how we learn from evidence in a rigorous way. And all of the steps in it are things that can be helpful, but they're not helpful if you don't have the right attitude. Making a prediction, shaping a hypothesis, making observations, it's not as if you can do those things in a particular order and truth is always going to come out the other end. I'll give you an example. Karl Popper talked about this in his book, Conjectures and Refutations. So the first step in the five-step method in the scientific method is supposed to be observe. Observe what? I mean, what do you notice? Just, you know, whatever jumps out. Most people have some sort of a hypothesis, some sort of a thing that they're curious about before they start their observations. This was something that Thomas Kuhn talked about and, you know, used it to say that even to question the idea that of the objectivity of science. So even though he too was a strong a believer in science. So this idea that there's some sort of a set method or way that every single scientist goes about what they do, I think is a myth. Now, here's the really interesting thing to me. It's a myth that has survived because I don't think anybody thought that we had any better alternative. So it was this myth that's written into the first page of all the textbooks, and you'll hear scientists talk about it, and sometimes you'll even hear philosophers talk about it. But they do so because I think that they're afraid that if they don't defend the idea that there's a scientific method, they can't defend science because it's the idea is so well ensconced in the general population that there's a scientific method. Now, so as I said, most philosophers don't believe in the idea that there's a scientific method. But so then what do they talk about? How do they defend science? What you find is that quite a number of them talk about, well, there's no recipe, but there is methodology. There are principles. There's a logic to science. And that has really been responsible for the last 80 to 100 years of the philosophy of science, trying to make the argument that, well, even if there isn't this list of things that we can do in a particular order, there are these logical, methodological principles that we can follow, and that's going to help us. But that, I claim, has led to a dead end, which is that after 100 years, we still can't solve the problem of demarcation, which is a scandal for the field, and what 3 years ago led me to think we've got to do better than this.
Describe what you mean by demarcation a little bit to our listeners.
So the problem of demarcation is this idea that there needs to be a way to distinguish between science and non-science, or better, think about science versus pseudoscience. So say you've got a question of, well, what's distinctive about science? Well, you try to answer that. And then astrology comes along and says, hey, wait a minute. Well, we fulfill that criteria. Well, then that gets philosophers back up. They want to say, well, no, you don't. So you can see that it depends very heavily on what your demarcation criteria is. Say your criteria of demarcation is, well, you have to rely on observational evidence. Well, everybody who searches for Bigfoot is going to say, we're scientific. We search, we go out in the field and we look for Bigfoot every weekend, so we're scientists. So, well, then you've got to have another criteria and another one and another one. And it finally reaches the point where, the philosophers have grabbed onto it and said, we need a set of individually necessary and sufficient conditions that, will sort all and only science on one side of the ledger and all and only that which isn't science on the other side of the ledger. And the problem is it has to be perfect. The analogy here, it really comes to signal detection theory. So imagine that you're a gunner in wartime and you have to shoot down enemy planes, but you have to let your own planes get over safely. You'd have to shoot down all and only the enemy planes and none of the friendly planes in order for your criteria of demarcation to work. If you made even one mistake, then your criteria of demarcation doesn't work. And you can just tell right away there's a problem here. I mean, you might say, well, I'm just going to let all the planes over, then I won't shoot down any friendlies, but then you've let over the enemy planes. Well, you could say, well, I'm going to shoot down every plane, but then of course you're shooting down the friendly planes. So you've got to have something right in the middle that works each and every time, and that has proven to be impossible.
Yeah, thanks. That was a really great explanation. I want to dig back into, you were kind of talking about the nuances between a scientific method as a method, a skill set. I like that skill set. And scientific attitude. Here we talk a lot about critical thinking, how it's a method, how it's a skill set and tools that you can have in your toolbox. But it's also an attitude. It's an outlook in how you approach topics and issues. Can you kind of dig into a scientific attitude, what you mean by that?
Sure.
And what that looks like, what that feels like?
Sure. And bless you for doing the work that you're doing, too, and the way that you're doing it. That's terrific. So I was very excited when I started to think about the scientific attitude. Because, I mean, I didn't invent the notion. It goes back to Francis Bacon and arguably, back even further than that. And also Karl Popper uses it. But I started to think about this idea that Karl Popper calls it the critical attitude. What's really distinctive about science, he feels, is that you need to be hard on your theories. You need to make these risky predictions and then test them. And if the data don't support your theory, then you have to give up the theory. That's what he thought was distinctive about science. And I think there's a lot to that. The problem is that he wanted to make it a logical criteria, which is where the problem comes in, because I think that an attitude is normative. I think it's values-based. The scientific attitude is an ethos that scientists share with one another that, no matter how they go about it, no matter what their methods or their procedures are, if they've got the idea that, number one, they care about evidence, and number two, they're willing to let new evidence change their beliefs, that's the scientific attitude. It's just as simple as that. The second part of that criteria is really the most important part, I think, because, again, the Bigfoot people can say, oh, I care about evidence. It depends on what you mean by evidence. But it's here's the distinction. To be able to say that I want to believe that X is true, but I've gone out and I've checked the data, and the data tell me that X is not true, therefore I'm going to give up that belief. That's what's distinctive about science. That's the scientific attitude. And once I started to think about that being the what was really distinctive about science, a lot of things fell into place. This whole idea in philosophy of science that there's a fact-value distinction, gone. Because to me, values are important. You can't say that science has to be value-free. It just depends very much on, you know, having the right values. And it also occurred to me that this is what's really wrong with science denial. And this is what's wrong with pseudoscience like astrology. Because they're not giving up their theories when the data say that they're not true. When somebody's a climate change denier and they're going around cherry-picking data that they think shows that their theory is true, and then you point out some refuting fact and they say, well, I don't care about that. They're not giving up their theory. When you present an anti-vaxxer with all these studies which show that it's actually been debunked, the idea that the MMR vaccine causes autism, they won't believe it because, again, they're not allowing themselves to change their mind based on evidence. The thing that I like about the scientific attitude is that it captures, I think, what's most essential about science, but it's flexible enough that we can use it to say what's distinctive about science, but also to separate it from science denial, from pseudoscience, and also, by the way, from fraud. Because if you think about it, that's what's really wrong with fraud in science. Fraud is committed by scientists who commit to the values of science, the ethos, the scientific attitude, and then cheat on it. And that's a scandal. I mean, we all understand what's the matter with fraud. Isn't that they're not making observations, they're not making predictions, they're not quote-unquote following the scientific method, but their values are wrong. They're cheating on this thing that we're all supposed to believe in science.
I want to explore that a little bit more as well, science denialism. You know, I think we hear about it in mainstream media, in particular climate change deniers. But what does... At the same time, having a critical thinking attitude means that you're sometimes skeptical and critical of ideas that are presented to you. So how can people help? How can we help them see science denial versus some healthy skepticism? And how can we interact with science denialists?
It's an absolutely terrific question. And science deniers use, they like to call themselves skeptics because it sounds so, nobody identifies themselves as a denier, of course. Here's how I draw the distinction. It depends on whether you have a double standard for evidence. It depends on just really that flexible attitude toward evidence. Because you're right that scientists, and I think Sagan talked about this a little bit in Demon Haunted World, they have to walk this fine line. They have to be open to new ideas, but also skeptical of those ideas until they've been tested. And so you're absolutely right that a healthy degree of skepticism is really important in science. But skepticism has to be earned. I mean, skepticism doesn't mean that you don't believe anything, no matter how good the evidence. Skepticism means that you withhold judgment when the evidence is insufficient to form a good belief, but that once you have enough evidence to form a reasonable belief, you believe it. So the problem with science deniers is that they don't do that. They'll often decide ahead of time what it is that they want to believe. And this is where the double standard comes in. Anything that they don't want to believe, no evidence is good enough to convince them. They think that science has to prove something 100% certain, or it's, you know, it's not worth believing at all. On the other hand, if it's something that they do want to believe, they really are quite gullible, and they require not much evidence at all to believe it. That sort of double standard, I think, is rampant in science denial. And here I'll give you a very concrete example. In November 2018, I wanted to get out of my study. The scientific attitude was already in page proofs, and so I couldn't make changes anymore. And I thought, I'm going to go to the Flat Earth Convention, which was out in Denver. And I spent 2 days, it was just me and some media there, but I stayed the entire 2 days with 600 of the worst science deniers on the planet. And I listened to them. I was calm. I was respectful. I listened to them. They claim that their views are based on evidence, that it's not faith-based, it's based on evidence. But of course, the reasoning mistakes were rampant. And, you know, they would say things like, well, you know, they didn't trust any of the pictures from NASA, that they were faked. They had this whole conspiracy theory about why the flat earth is being withheld from school children and from the rest of us. So the frustrating thing was, any evidence that you present, they've got a reason why that isn't good evidence. And yet their own evidence is extremely shoddy. And so having that double standard, you know, not conditioning their beliefs to the evidence, not really believing in the idea of probability or warranted belief for that matter. Based on the evidence, is really the difference. And as you can see, that's kind of a fine thing. I mean, whether somebody has the scientific attitude or not is not judged by them. It's judged by the community. It's judged by the community of other people who share the scientific attitude. So it does happen sometimes in scientific practice that people make mistakes and their colleagues have to correct them. Or sometimes the entire field has made a mistake and you've got a Galileo who corrects them. But the point is that it's corrected by evidence. Yeah. That's the key.
And so there are examples in science where theories have been held on to even after some of the evidence is out there that those theories are probably rightfully being challenged. And oftentimes it's the people who develop the theories that hold on to those. They have a lifelong career involved. Yeah. But there's many examples of that doesn't last that long. I mean, it can last for a while, but if the anomalies keep cropping up and there's the evidence sways it away from the current theory, those theories do change.
They do. I mean, Thomas Kuhn had a very funny line in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions where he more or less, you know, he talks about paradigm shifts and, you know, how theories change. And he more or less says, well, what happens is that people don't change their mind. It's just that the old guys die off and they take their old ideas with them. That does happen. You know, if you look at the resistance to the germ theory of disease in the mid-19th century, if you look at some
Galileo is a very good example.
Galileo. In continental drift, some other examples from geology come to mind. One of which I wrote about in the book, and you know, what do you do in a situation like this? The evidence eventually brings the other people around. Now, it doesn't always. Sometimes people are so attached to their theory that they just can't listen to anybody else, and effectively, at that point, they've left the profession. They're no longer scientists. I'm not talking about the fraudsters. I'm talking because they know what they're doing. I'm talking about the people who just are so attached to their theory that they will not believe any evidence, even when it refutes their theory. Well, here I'm thinking of something more like cold fusion, where they just would not follow good practices.
I'm still really mad about Galileo, though, because he was put on house arrest for bringing evidence about what he knew about our planet and its position in the solar system, and the church repeatedly used its power to keep it down. And I think about 10 or 15 years ago, they finally said they made an oopsie.
350 years later. It's really incredible. I mean, I think of Galileo as being the person who really brought the scientific attitude to the natural sciences. Before Galileo, natural science was natural philosophy. People had different theories based on all sorts of conjectures, but they weren't experimenting. They weren't using data to change their mind. I'm sitting right now in my study upstairs at the back of my house, and I've got children's drawings and diplomas and newspaper clippings all over. I only have one portrait of a person on my wall, and it's Galileo.
He was one of the giants whose shoulders were stood on by Newton.
Yes.
Let's move on a little bit. Here in your book, The Scientific Attitude, you explain very clearly, I think, because of the inductive nature of reasoning as opposed to deductive reasoning, the inductive method, which is used in forming the body of most scientific knowledge, science never proves any hypothesis or theories because the nature of inductive evidence is that there is always a chance that somewhere down the line someone will find new evidence that falsifies the theory or the hypothesis. And I get that. We've talked about that on this show before. In fact, I usually use the wording, the evidence supports the idea that whatever that is, if it's an inductive reasoning process. But in chapter two, you go on to say, but the problem is that we also cannot say that a theory is even more likely to be true on the basis of these tests and, you know, further evidence. So that's another thing that I have to question, and I'm anxious to hear your philosophy on that. So help me understand how that's so, because I always thought that, for example, if we had three good studies showing that a drug was effective for treating a disease, that would make the hypothesis much more likely to be true than if we only had one unreplicated study. It's the Bayesian approach to gaining new evidence. So help me understand how it can be that it doesn't even make it more probable.
Okay, so you've put your finger on the very nub of the philosophical question in this debate. The problem of induction has just been a bugaboo for epistemology, for the philosophy of science since its inception. And it's this difficulty of being able to say when you know something that you can be certain that you know it. By the way, Hume was upset by this too. Hume, the person who came up with the problem of induction. The problem of induction is really quite, I mean, it's so clever. It's this idea that with deduction, you've got certainty because your conclusion follows certainly from the premises. If you say, if it's raining, the streets are wet, and it's raining, therefore the streets are wet, there's nothing in the conclusion that isn't contained in the premises. So you don't even have to look outside to know whether that syllogism is true. But with induction, what you're doing is you're looking at maybe a piece of the world, and you're noticing a pattern, and then you're extrapolating it to the rest of the world. Here's the problem. How do you know that the rest of the world looks like the piece that you've already seen? If the universe is infinite in space and infinite in time, the sample that you've looked at might be infinitesimally small compared to what you're projecting it to out in the world. Well, that's just the problem of induction 101. The students understand at a certain point that, oh, I see, so that means you can't be certain. Here's the insidious part of it, and even Hume knew this. It also means that you can't have probability. It means that you can't, not only is your thesis that you're extrapolating from on this little sample of the world to the larger part of the world not certain to be true, it's not even more likely to be true. Now, this is a scandal, right? This is a scandal. But I'm going to say that it's a scandal for philosophy, not for science, because the problem here is that this problem drove Popper crazy. It drove him so crazy that he said that science wasn't even based on induction. And he had this, you know, very clever way to show that it was actually based on deduction through falsification, which is a little, take me a little while to explain. But he had this very clever hypothesis about this. But the issue here is that the scandal, I think, is that by trying to take this problem of induction so seriously and make knowing into a matter of logic, even when we're talking about knowledge of the empirical world, we trip over ourselves and we got caught up in this question of certainty. There's a difference between saying you know something and saying that you know that you know. And so this problem of certainty is the is the difficulty. And I think that but once philosophers give up the idea that they need to be certain and they recognize that all empirical knowledge is fallible, of course we could be wrong. And by the way, that's what's most essential about science. Otherwise, why would new evidence count? Yes, there's always some uncertainty. We need to embrace that and not be embarrassed by it. So, I mean, in that sense, Hume is very liberating to us to make us embrace the idea that there's uncertainty and use that to push back against science deniers and say, no, we don't have to be 100% certain. But now, here's the real rub of your question. What about probability? What, you know, how can't we, does the problem of induction end up saying that the thing that we've got so much evidence for is not even more likely to be true? As a technical matter, in logic, that is correct. But I think that that's not what you need for belief. What you need for belief is warrant. You need justification. Mm-hmm. You need to be able to say that the thing that has the three good tests in its favor makes that belief warranted. It doesn't make it more likely to be true, because how can you assess that? How, you know, if the universe is infinite in space and time, then the piece that you've sampled is infinitesimally small. It can't even be defined relative to the your sample relative to the entire size. So I think that scientists and philosophers of science need to stop talking about truth and certainty, and they need to start talking about warrant and justification. Mm-hmm. And in the book, I have a couple of pages just after I introduce this problem, where I start to say that, of course, positive instances count. Of course, we can have more confidence in our theory when it's got more positive data behind it. But what that doesn't show is that we're certain, and it doesn't show that our theory is more likely to be true. And here I'm going to make some enemies amongst philosophers called realists, but it doesn't show that our theory is more likely to be true. What it shows is that we're justified in believing in it, that it's a rational thing to believe. And I actually go so far in the argument to say something that I think I'm the first person ever to say it in public, because I Googled it. How many times you ever Google something, you get only one hit. And so I Googled this, and I got one hit, and it was to my own book. And the phrase is, to hell with the problem of induction. the problem of induction was not meant to paralyze us. It was not meant to mean that we could never know anything. It just means that we need to be careful not to say that we're certain, or not that we know that something is true.
The blood is coming back to Bob's face. Yeah. I wish you could see the faces that he was making.
I was right there with him. I was starting to go crazy with this one.
Well, and I'm also
worried about it. Yeah.
And I worry that sometimes to use a term that you used for the title of one of your books, like in a post-truth world, sometimes I'm a little scared that we're slipping into a meaningless postmodern hell. I don't know what else to call it, but
I agree with you strongly. And you know, the irony is, I mean, in that book, in post-truth, I defend very strongly the concept of truth. I do.
Yeah. And part of the problem is that if we're trying to explain evidence to people, if we can't use the word probable, and we have to resort to the idea of more warranted.
I've never seen Bob make faces like this before.
That would be very difficult to construct arguments with most people about. So, but
and that's why I think it's okay in an everyday setting to use facts, truth, just in the way that we've always naturally used them, and I do that as well, but it's in this technical, logical sense that you can't say that something's true unless you can verify that it's true. And if the problem of induction is correct, which I think it is, then we can never do that. Mm-hmm. I don't want to give any aid and comfort to the whole post-truth undermining of the idea that, you know, truth isn't true, or there are alternative facts. I wrote an entire book about that. I don't want to give any aid and comfort to that, because I think that that's related to science denial.
Yeah.
What I'm making the argument for here is really this: we need to defend facts and truth and science, but we need to do it in an honest way. We need to understand what is really distinctive about it. Mm-hmm. And if we're buying into this myth of truth and certainty, then what's going to happen when the science denier, call themselves a skeptic, say, oh, really? Well, you haven't proven global warming? Come back to me when you've proven it. Mm-hmm. What do you say to them? You just walk away because they don't understand.
Yeah.
And I think that we need to make them understand, because as I make the argument in the book, we need to embrace the idea that uncertainty is not a dirty word. Being able to say, no, we don't have 100% proof. What we do have is overwhelming evidence mm-hmm. in favor of this hypothesis, which means that we're justified in believing that it's true. Could it be false? Absolutely, it could be. Any empirical hypothesis could be false. Now, the science denier at that point says, well, then my theory might be true. Well, it might be, but what's your evidence? And at that point, again, when you're weighing up evidence, you're saying, you know, given the evidence, is your theory justified? No, it's not. And I think that, you know, we need to embrace that idea, because scientists, I just read the other day in Reuters that the evidence for climate change had now passed the 5 sigma level. So there's only a 1 out of 1 million shot that the climate change deniers are right. Mm-hmm. It's completely irrational to be a climate change denier. And so they'll say, well, 1 out of 1 million, you might be wrong. Yeah, we might be wrong, but we're not.
Well, as Bob says, the evidence supports the idea. It's yes. It's a very succinct way of kind of putting that out there.
Okay, well,
I love that.
We're getting into science denialism, the scientific attitude, the role of science in policy and medicine. We haven't really talked about that yet. And while we're waiting for some phone calls, we will maybe say a few words about, because climate denialism, we have a call. All right, let's go to our first caller. Caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello, caller.
Well, thank you so much for this program, and thank your guest for this program. I hear such clarity on KMUD almost never. I really appreciate it.
We'll take that as a compliment.
My father was a historian of science, and I'm hearing a lot of stuff that I agree with here and that I wish more people were familiar with. So thanks so much, Bob and Julie, and especially thank your guest.
Well, thank you, caller. Wow, that was a nice call.
Yeah. That was a nice endorsement.
You know, so we had a call, it was a little while ago, and it was, at the time, we didn't really get to dig into it, but I think it might be a good time. A caller called in and said something along the lines of, is believing in science a belief in and of itself? Like, a belief system, you know, or being religious? I know it's kind of a open-ended sort of question, but I think it's something that people ask.
And the word scientism is used to mm-hmm. To convey that kind of connotation too. What do you have to say about that?
It's a phrase that's sometimes used by people who want to argue that science is just one way of knowing, and that there are other perfectly equivalent ways. And by the way, usually the next thing that comes is the agenda that their beliefs should also be taught in the science classroom. Mm-hmm. So this is a tactic that's often used by evolution deniers, for instance, to make the claim that, well, evolution is just a religion. Evolution there's not this distinction between science and religion. Evolution is itself a religion. And so if you're going to teach that in the biology classroom, then you can teach creationism. Now, that's not a very sophisticated view, and that way of putting it has gone out a long time ago. But one thing that the new agenda to get creationism into the classroom was something called intelligent design, which they, you know, made the argument, well, no, this is we've got evidence, and this is a very scientific belief. There were some court cases that came up over it. Was found that it, you know, was not actually scientific. But you know, this entire this claim that science is not better than other ways of knowing, or that science is shot through and infected with all of these ideologies, I don't think that's right. And I think that the important thing to remember is that to the extent that there scientists do have cognitive biases like everyone else has, and science isn't perfect. There are mechanisms. There are ways to hold one another accountable. We have peer review. We share data. We try to replicate one another's experiments. Those are all ways for scientists to keep one another honest, even if they were honest in the first place. And that's the antidote to ideology. Somebody who wants to believe something because they want to believe it, and then they go out shopping for evidence, that's not science. Science is about basing your beliefs and changing your beliefs on evidence. And I think that is distinctive. And I really am going to stand by the quotation that you used for me at the opening, that I think that science is the greatest invention of the human mind for studying the empirical world. There's nothing else like it to keep us on track and not trying to fool ourselves. A better quotation from Richard Feynman was when he said that science was what we did to keep from fooling ourselves.
For those folks who may endorse your quote that you just quoted yourself as saying, and we've talked a little bit about climate deniers and denialism having to do with that. The thing I want to get into a little bit is saying scientific consensus, because we've heard that there's a great deal of scientific consensus among the experts in climate area that there is climate change. But how do we actually get our handle on what scientific consensus is in these various fields? What I'm looking for, and I've searched for it, it doesn't exist, it's probably a fantasy, maybe it'll be here tomorrow, is a web page that is accurately documented and has references for various areas in the different fields that can give me a read on what scientific consensus is. Do you have any words of wisdom?
Yeah, one thing that I really enjoy, the Pew polls. The Pew polls tend to do a good job over time.
P-E-W.
Yeah. They measure how many people believe in climate change, how many people believe in vaccines, et cetera, et cetera. But then they also compare it to what the scientific consensus is. And so you can get a sense of how big of a split there might be on GMOs, on climate change, on vaccines, on topics like that. So I've found those interesting. And the other thing is, because they do them often enough, you can watch how they change over time. Now, these are opinion polls, so they're not necessarily, you know, an ideal way to measure scientific consensus. But I found them useful because they use scientific consensus as a baseline for then measuring how far public opinion is away from scientific consensus. But so, Bob, your question was how do you measure scientific consensus in and of itself? Other than just reading the literature, you said you're looking for a website. One website that I've found very useful is NCSE.com, the National Center for Science Education. They do a very good job of talking about science and science under threat, especially about evolution and about climate change, talking about what the consensus is. If you're looking for numbers, sometimes they'll have it, but what they do a very nice job, because they're concerned with science education, is doing the same sorts of things that you guys are doing, right? Talking about reason, talking about how to think critically about science. There's also a website, I want to get it right now since I'm going to say it on the air, so I'm going to have to Google it while I'm talking to you here. But it's something, Skeptical Science, I think it's called, and they have some very good statistical work on this as well.
I love that this is what Bob fantasizes about, is like, I imagine like a Wikipedia of peer review science.
These things pop into my head as I'm slowly going to sleep at night. Wouldn't it be a wonderful world?
I'm often concerned about, do we have another caller?
I think we do.
Oh, we do.
It's called skepticalscience.com.
Skepticalscience.com. Is that with a K or a C?
And we will link to these.
K.
All right. Skeptical with a K.
We will link to these on our Facebook page, but I think we have another caller.
Let's hear from the caller.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hello, caller.
Good evening.
Good evening.
You know, there's as I listen to you, I keep thinking there's a troublesome matter here that I'd like to hear you address. That's reproducibility. A few years back, there was quite a hoorah in the social sciences, I think it was psychology, when it was determined that something like 30 to 40% of the research paper's findings were not reproducible. And that problem can be found in other areas, even supposedly hard science areas, where perhaps the procedures are so recondite that nobody else can reproduce them. So let me hear a little bit about reproducibility, because that kind of
that's a very good question.
Sure.
It is a good question, and you'll be happy to know that I have an entire discussion of the replication and reproducibility problem in my book, The Scientific Attitude, because what I wanted to do in defending science was not just defend the caricature of it. I wanted to defend it as it really existed, warts and all, problems and all. And one problem was this problem of, as you say. And so what I did was I studied the literature, and you're right that there was this study that came out of the Center for Open Science, which, you know, made the claim that, you know, I think what they did was they looked at 100 different studies and found that, you know, a shockingly high number of them, can't remember, it was 30 or 40% of them, maybe even more, were unreproducible. Here's the part of the story that few people know. They then did another study of that study and found that it was irreproducible. And they went back and looked at the original studies and found that if you did it the right way, only a few of them were unreproducible, and it was no more than you would expect from sampling theory and in probability. Now, there's no fraud here. You know, we're not talking about people who are we're talking in some sense a scandal, I suppose. But the interesting part of it for me was that science has a way to adjudicate this. You know, if you look at the problems in the sciences, if you look at ways that scientists sort of cheat that's not quite fraud, like something called p-hacking, which I've got a description of in the book, where you're looking for correlations where you know that they probably don't exist in the real world. They're just naive or statistical correlations. That's the problem of p-hacking. Or the problem of replication. These are warts. These are problems in science. But the interesting part for me is to look at how scientists respond to them. They don't just lay down. They now study p-hacking. Different journals talk about, that they won't accept articles anymore that are, according to this criteria. They're not even asking for p-values anymore. With replication, there's another website called retractionwatch.org. I think it's now retractionwatch.com, where you can go through and you can look at studies that have been retracted. So the very fact that we're in science, that they shine a light on these problems, I think is distinctive. The fact that science is self-critical, I think is absolutely important, and I hope that if you're interested in this problem, and I'm fascinated with this, which is why I put it in the book. This idea that the study that found that the results couldn't be replicated was itself unreplicable. This was really just follow it down the rabbit hole. It was just fascinating, and I'm looking here to try to figure out where it is in the book. It's on page 105 in my book. I've got that to discussion, and. I think that the best that you can do in science is admit that there are problems and see if there are ways to deal with it and try to fix them.
And there's a lot being done, making a pledge before actually publication to make all data available for reanalysis by colleagues and peers is another one. Time stamping. Sometimes people make their hypothesis post hoc of what
yes.
they found, what they
That's
find,
right.
and you can time stamp and pre-record your hypothesis, saying, indicating
right.
that you hypothesized this truly before your data collection started. So people are taking
yeah.
it, scientists are taking this seriously, and I guess we would lump some of this under the scientific attitude.
They are. Some journals are now requiring that to pre-register the hypothesis before
right.
they start the paper. And you brought up a very important example there about data sharing. Another scandal that I talk about in the book It was uncovered by, I can't remember the name, but I read about it in a secondary account by Robert Trivers on his blog. And he talked about the fact that there were many scientists who were doing in psychology who were publishing in journals that required them to share their data, and they weren't sharing their data. Yeah. And that if you, but if you looked at those papers, the people who wouldn't share the data, sometimes there were quantitative errors in them. So again, this isn't fraud, but it's right up to the lip of it. And you know, how do they respond to it? Again, I think by shining a light on it, by not trying to sweep it under the rug and pretend that these aren't problems in science. Science is rigorous enough to police itself, to find these problems that exist and figure out a way to deal with it. And so I didn't hold anything back. I wasn't trying, you mentioned before the word scientism. I don't think that science is perfect, and I talk about those imperfections in the book and the ways that science deals with them.
Okay. Well, we're
just about out of time.
So many more questions.
I do have a question, but we're really getting to the bottom there. So.
Yeah, there's numerous questions. Maybe we can get you back sometime.
I want to do another hour right now.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, that's the problem with live radio, though. So at any rate, do you have any parting thoughts to leave with our audience in the last minute or so that we have here?
Yeah, one thing that I want to make sure that people understand is that despite all these threats from science denial, and despite all the difficulties of science that we've talked about, and you know, the inability to say that anything is true or certain, I think that science is wonderful. And I just want to read the last paragraph to, you know, spoil the ending of my own book, if I could. I make the argument that just as science is real, the scientific attitude is real. Even if it's difficult to define and hard to measure, it makes up the core difference between what's science and what is not. Science is still special, even if it's not quite what we thought it was. So I think that science is quite special, quite distinctive, but it's not the caricatured version that we all learned in school, and it's not what the science deniers and the pseudoscientists tell it is. It's an attitude, it's an ethos, it's a community standard of belief that leads us to be curious about nature and to learn from evidence.
Very well put.
And I really liked antidote to ideology. I really like that.
Dr. Lee McIntyre, I want to thank you very much. It was an extreme pleasure. And at our Facebook page, we'll link to your latest book, The Scientific Attitude, and the book before that, aptly called Post-Truth. And thank you very much to our engineer, Nate Dogg, and Julia. As always, thank you,
Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking
thank
clearly.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
It's your first and your last chance.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studios and is provided courtesy of KMUD, people-powered radio.